I am sick as a dog right now. Spent about a half hour throwing up. I've had a migraine since I woke up this morning. And as Hatman can attest to, right before we got started, I popped my neck and it sounded like a gunshot. But I'm here anyway. I'm in my suit anyway. And there's one reason that I am, above all else, is because I believe in what needs to be said today, here, Wednesday, October the 11th of 2017. Because I think that there is work that we do on this podcast that is important to let people know about the culture from the ground level. To let people know the thought processes behind the terrible things that go on so we can understand it so that we don't repeat this 10, 20, 30 years down the future. But the reason I'm gutting it out today is because I believe in the work that my partner, Alex, has done in regards to reading this Antifa book, dissecting it, understanding it, so that he can answer your questions about it. Because, ladies and gentlemen, this podcast is for you specifically, to ask us, what is it that makes Antifa tick? What is in the Antifa handbook? My name is Micah Curtis.
And I'm Alex Baldwin, also known as the Hatman.
And welcome to the special edition of Mike and the Hatman, the Antifa Handbook Dissected. Okay. Whew. I'm ready to go. Let's do this.
All right.
So, folks who are in the chat, please go right ahead and make your questions known to us, and we will answer them as they come along. But Hatman, I'm going to let you start this off. Why don't you go ahead and give the audience the history of Antifa?
All right. So, the history of Antifa is, of course, going to be synonymous with the history of fascism. Antifa does come out fighting fascists early 1920s, really, because that's when the fascists started to rise. But it's rather curious. It seems like fascism, at least as this book describes it, arose more as a counter to communism than anything else. Because the fascists described in here are the natural enemies of communists, so it stands to reason that the anti-fascists would be communists, and that's essentially where it begins. 1920s Italy. Fighting the Blackshirts. I apologize if I mispronounce this at all. My Italian is awful, but the Arditi del Popolo, first group that organizes specifically to fight Mussolini's black shirts. And of course, they and other communists get targeted during the time. Then you have the anti-fascist action in Germany. And again, I apologize if my not English is improper there, because English speaker. And then there are other groups, like I believe it's the 43 group in Great Britain. Basically, ex-World War II veterans preventing the rise of fascism in the British Isles. But a lot of it is exaggerated, I suppose. At least the victories are exaggerated. Like, obviously, the anti-fascists did not stop Mussolini from gaining power. They did not stop the Nazis from gaining power. And it's debatable that they stopped neo-fascist groups since then. because at that point the world had seen what fascism was capable of and was more turned off by it. So it's debatable if they had any sort of effect whatsoever. But it does come back to the idea that these are communist or anarchist groups since the very beginning fighting what they perceive to be right-wing extremism. It's not always on-the-nose fascism, but it is right-wing, and it is what they perceive to be as dangerous. Now, whether or not this is explicitly they believe that it is a clear and present danger, or if they honestly just call everything that's right-wing dangerous, it isn't clear. But it seems to me that it's more the latter. Because being anti-statists, communists, socialists, whatever you want to call it, they make the argument that capitalism is the reason why fascism is allowed to thrive. A capitalist state will give value to fascism, or at least allow the idea to persist, and therefore always keep that possibility around.
That brings up another question. So, fascists throughout history tend to not be fully capitalist. I think the only one who had a very, the loosest of all fascist or dictators, just in general. Let's just throw dictators out in general. Because, you know, you and I both use horseshoe theory. Mm-hmm. Not everyone does. I think we're one of the few. I think everybody categorizes left and right a little differently than we do. Because I think you and I are closer to the center than anything. I'm not a centrist, but anyway, I'm banging on. Sorry about that. Point being is that I think that the most loosely governed economy within a what you could call a fascist state was Pinochet.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is this: how are they defining, or how does the book justify the idea that the free market, you know, loosely regulated capitalism causes fascism?
Well, it's basically the idea that it's always going to devolve into practices that harm the consumer, or at least harm the poorest consumer. They argue, or Bray argues, the author Mark Bray, he argues essentially that capitalism helps oppress the already most marginalized people. So allowing it to continue, even with regulations, is going to continue to push them down and elevate the wealthy, the privileged. So therefore, it's not a matter of reforming it, it's a matter of breaking it. Because if you allow oppression in the capitalist state, then you're going to allow that to persist in a fascist state. The logic is really fuzzy, of course, but that's really the core of it.
Hmm.
I mean, it sounds very similar to arguments that we've heard from, you know, your rank and file social justice warriors over the years. And that's essentially what Antifa is. This is the next step of that. Or
it's the logical conclusion. Like I argued.
Yeah, the logical conclusion. Yeah. It's not, I guess I couldn't really call it the next step since this has been around since before even the term SJW got popularized, much less their politics. But this is the evolution of that. This is the logical conclusion.
And Thestaram asks in the chat here, do you think they're equating extreme corporatism with capitalism?
No.
No.
No, it is specifically capitalism. He actually addresses the idea of corporatism and says, no, it's the idea of the capitalist mindset. Until the people own the means of production and private property rights are abolished, you are going to have oppression in that regard.
So we should make no bones about it. This man is a Marxist.
Oh, absolutely he is. Absolutely. I mean, he openly called for class warfare. The entire point of the last section of the book, and really the whole book itself, is that the world needs to be transformed. It needs to become a socialist, stateless world. Not so much like a one-world government, though it's kind of weird because he argues that being Euro-skeptic is being fascist, even though he himself is an anti-statist. I don't understand the logic there.
That's incredibly contradictory.
It is.
I mean, let's look at the European Union for a moment, because most Euro-skeptics are closer to libertarian in their beliefs. You know, except for, you know, certain outliers. You know, neither of us were a fan of Marine Le Pen, for example. But what Marine Le Pen basically wanted to do is just get out of the EU, but basically turn France into a national socialist state. There was actually a very scary interview that I saw with the Marine Le Pen's mother, I think it is, mother or aunt. No, it was her mom, because she divorced her Marine Le Pen's father, who had said that he fed them German propaganda, his children. So, kind of dodged a bullet there. But anyway, point being, how does he justify that? That line of thought?
Which one exactly?
In regards to Euroscepticism being fascist in nature.
Oh, that it's basically wanting to get out of the European Union is essentially wanting to establish a nationalist state, and the primary reason for leaving the EU is due to the mishandling of the migrant crisis, which he describes as inherently Islamophobic.
And what does he propose as an alternative? Or does he even have
he doesn't.
A
alternative? Yeah, no.
Okay, figures.
No, he doesn't. Of course not. Some people in the chat are wanting me to link the book. I do believe that there is a version of it you can read on like Google Books or whatever it's called. But I have this in print. So just Google or search Amazon for Google being shorthand for search the internet for Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook by Mark Bray. If you want to just copy pasta, it's literally in the video description.
Yes. If one of the moderators could please go ahead and link that in the chat for us. If it's unavailable, I will put it in the description.
But most interesting, though, is the bit where he more or less says that Antifa is a terrorist group.
He admits this.
He does, actually. Let me find it. I've got flags all in here, but unfortunately the flags can only do so much. I've got, I believe, 214 flags in this. One separated by five colors. One is just of general interest. One is for promotion of violence. One is for Marxism. One is for anarchism. And one is for general, what we would call social justice warrior logic. And Of course, the general interest flags take up the majority of it, but the violence flags are, like, right behind there. So, just a general idea of what this is like. Jeez, where is that bit? I've got it saved on Twitter. I can do that, too.
I wanted, okay. Before, while you're still looking that, did you find it?
I've got the quote, yes.
Okay.
Okay, so... I'll just go ahead and read it. Quote, "It's surreal to watch liberal pundits lambast anti-fascists for disrupting a fascist speech when the revolutionary socialist ideology advocates the global expropriation of the capitalist ruling class and the destruction or capture of all existing states by means of an international popular uprising that most believe will necessitate violent confrontation with state forces. If they are critical of no platform, wait till they hear about class war." And it's funny because just a few pages later, he straight up says, as if Antifa were an organization, let alone terrorist. Despite the fact that he has talked about organized Antifa in like the first two-thirds of the book and literally just described terrorist ideology right there. Whoops.
I'm so confused by his attempt at logic. It's so poor. I'm sorry.
Oh.
Somebody mentioned my eyebrow raising, like me raising my eyebrow at it. It's like, I there's it's like a logical black hole. It just fell in and stopped existing.
Oh, of course there is. I mean, his argument against the marketplace of ideas is basically, well, it's going to permit hateful ideologies. If we want to get rid of hateful ideologies, we have to abolish the marketplace altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it's a capitalist analogy, so we have to hate it. It's hilarious.
So safe to say it's an anti-free speech mantra that he is preaching here, though.
Well, interestingly enough, he has an entire section called "Are Anti-Fascists Anti-Free Speech?" Shall I read from this?
Absolutely.
Okay, I will read the whole thing because it's small, but it's very important. The only thing I ask is just don't interrupt. Everybody can go ham on it afterwards. But anyway, "Are anti-fascists anti-free speech? If capital and the state indeed render speech far less free than pundits generally presume, it's fair to compare the existing speech regime to that which most Antifa advocate. Anti-fascism is pan-revolutionary left politics applied to fighting the far right. Therefore, a number of socialist traditions coexist under this umbrella. Since the establishment of ARA, which is Anti-Racist Action, and its growth in the 90s, most American Antifa have been anarchists or anti-authoritarian communists. Certainly, some have been Stalinists and other kinds of authoritarians who have supported the efforts of the Soviet Union and similar regimes to very narrowly delineate the range of acceptable speech. From that standpoint, free speech, as such, is merely a bourgeois fantasy unworthy of consideration. Since I strongly disagree with the authoritarian position, which is only held by a minority of today's anti-fascists in the United States, I will not make any effort to defend it. Instead, I will observe that the anti-authoritarian position held by the majority of Antifa is actually far more pro-free speech than put forward by liberals. The false assumption that the United States maximizes free speech rests on the unstated fact that this right only applies to non-incarcerated citizens. Therefore, millions of people in the United States are deprived of elements of this freedom. In contrast, anti-authoritarians seek to abolish prisons, states, and the very notion of citizenship, thereby eliminating this black hole of rightlessness. They also aim to construct a classless, post-capitalist society that would eradicate significant discrepancies in our ability to make our speech meaningful and in the amount of time that we have to do so. By not devoting resources to prisons, police, and the military, such a post-capitalist society would be able to put far more into supporting education, the arts, and collective expression and inquiry. While this creation of a classless society would eliminate the majority of crime stemming from capitalist antagonisms, Antifa argued that methods of restorative justice should replace police and prisons in addressing conflicts that persist. Rather than collaborating with oppressive regimes around the world, anti-authoritarians aspire to destroy them by organizing in solidarity with those who are actively resisting from below. The anti-authoritarian principle of individual and collective autonomy promotes a vision of human diversity and plurality at odds with the stifling homogeneity of capitalist consumer culture. If fascists were to start organizing in such a society, anti-authoritarian anti-fascists would still organize to shut them down, but they would not construct massive prisons to lock them up as the American government has done to countless political prisoners over the generations. Many will argue that this is simply impossible. Even if that were true, however, what is at issue here are the values being espoused, not the likelihood of being enacted. Pundits attack Antifa for being anti-free speech. Yet, even if you agree that shutting down fascist organizing constitutes an infringement upon the free speech of fascists, it is still patently obvious that anti-fascists advocate for far more free speech in society than liberals, both quantitatively and qualitatively.
Okay, so something needs to be established here. How does he define who is fascist?
Let me go back to the very beginning.
Apologies, I feel that we're missing something here, because, and I know you and I have discussed this for before behind closed doors. I want everyone else to hear what we talked about in regards to what he defines as fascist and far right. We've already seen that he sees capitalism as something that leads to fascism, and does a terrible job of really explaining how that happens. Goodness. While you look that up, let me go ahead and there was a statement in the chat room earlier about nationalism and saying that it does not always lead, and it's something that needs to be I felt it was a very good point, is that it does not lead to fascism naturally. Nationalism is a very broad term. You know, anybody technically who is patriotic is a nationalist in the state that he believes in his nation. It's just why you are a nationalist is important. Are you a nationalist because it's where you live, or are you a nationalist because you believe in the principles and traditions of the nation? Donald Trump is a nationalist, but he's not a nationalist in the sense that Hitler was a nationalist. He's a nationalist in the sense of he believes in the Constitution, he believes in American tradition. Michael Knowles actually made a very good argument yesterday on his podcast that Trump is a traditionalist. I don't think Trump defines himself in such terms, but I think there was a lot of truth to what he said. But in a lot of states, there's a huge amount of national pride. But it's not just because of the border. It's because of what created the nation and why it is as free as it is. Because, to be frank, the United States is nothing without the Constitution. It's just a landmass with the weirdest weather patterns and more hurricanes you can shake a stick at.
Okay, so I have a definition. All right, so he goes by historian Robert Paxton's definition, which is a form of political behavior marked by obsessive preoccupation with community decline, humiliation, or victimhood, and by compensatory cults of unity, energy, and purity, in which a mass-based party of committed nationalist militants, working in uneasy but effective collaboration with traditional elites, abandons democratic liberties and pursues with redemptive violence and without ethical or legal restraints goals of internal cleansing and external expansion. Of note, he also goes along with Paxton's argument that fascism, or quote, fascism understood functionally, was born in the late 1860s in the American South with the appearance of the Ku Klux Klan.
Okay.
So, evidently, the KKK were fascists and fascism started in America somehow. I don't get it. I mean, literally, the argument is violent intimidation, alternative networks of authority, and uniforms. So, like Occupy Wall Street?
Or Antifa?
Or Antifa? it's almost funny.
Yeah, they well, and that's part of the reason as to why I still stick to the horseshoe theory when I know a lot of other people that we know have abandoned it. It's because there is so much truth in the idea that a lot of similarities tend to happen the closest you get, or the closer you get to authoritarianism. It all just tends to blend together and look alike. The difference that I usually see and is present within this book is that on the right side of the horseshoe, there's more of a national, a certain type of nationalism, whereas on the left, it tends to be a bit more globalistic, but it's not perfect. I mean, neoconservatives tend to be a little bit more globalistic as well, but yeah, it's politics is a mess.
So, let's open up the questions again. See if there's anything that I can answer here.
If the KKK created fascism, wouldn't technically the creators of fascism have been the Confederacy?
Well, I mean, if you really want to tear down those monuments, all you have to do is say they're monuments to fascism.
I was about to say, I think I have a feeling that that's probably the same conclusion that Antifa came to that I just did. If that's your line of logic, I don't agree with it. I don't think that they were fascist at all. I think that they were a very authoritarian, had a very authoritarian mindset. The leadership of the Confederacy did anyway. You know, obviously I'm not talking about the ground soldiers or people like Jackson or Stonewall Jackson or Robert E. Lee. Yeah, it's a, Panda Palace puts it quite well in the chat here. This book is a load of horse shit.
It is. So, I see a question.
Did you have to pay for this? Because that would be ironic. That is a good question.
Okay. Yes, I did have to pay for it. I actually found this in a Barnes & Noble and bought it. I paid actual money that I earned through employment for this. And ironically enough, it says in the introduction, quote, at the very least 50% of author proceeds will go to the International Anti-Fascist Defense Fund, which is administered by more than 300 Antifa from 18 countries. So I inadvertently funded a terror group.
Fuck.
Yes, very.
Let's see here.
I do see a question earlier on. Where did this handbook come from? Basically, Bray says since Trump's election, he'd been working on it, and he conducted a bunch of interviews over years and such, though I think that mostly came from his time in the anarchist movement and in Occupy. But I presume that he did more work with Antifa groups to put this together. But it is explicitly made to describe the group that has been appearing in the media. So this is sort of like an explanation for people who don't know what Antifa is but just heard about it on CNN. But it's also an argument in favor of Antifa, but it's not really trying to convince anyone who isn't already on board with some of their beliefs. It's all over the place, really. The most interesting bits of it are, in fact, the history. Because you can go and you know, do your own research on that. That's where most of my notes came from. How he likes to gloss over the fact that a lot of these movements and a lot of these people highlighted did some pretty atrocious stuff. I mean, he conveniently glosses over the terrorism of Weather Underground, for example. I don't know what else to say. Yeah, it is more or less preaching to the choir.
Hmm.
Especially the latter half of it. I mean, there's like three sections for the history. It's World War II, post-war, and then modern day. And the modern day stuff does have to deal with Trump and whatnot, and like Golden Dawn in Greece, and the skinheads in the 90s, that sort of thing. So that's stuff that's more preaching to the choir, because that's stuff that most of the people that will read this will know about and or identify with.
Hmm. Let's go ahead and answer a few more questions here. Does Antifa, do they have anything to say about games, anime, music, movies, and other mediums in regards to entertainment?
Not that I remember, though Gamergate did get name dropped.
There's a game drop in this.
There is a game drop in this, actually.
Go on.
Basically tying it to Milo Yiannopoulos.
Hmm.
Because Milo is talked about. The Battle of Berkeley is explicitly talked about. But Gamergate was called, quote, the online harassment of feminist and non-white game developers, media critics, and actors for challenging the patriarchy and white supremacy of the geek domain. And it's funny. Some of you might know about that little bit because I did post it on Twitter. It comes with a citation. He's got upwards of... No, he's got exactly 450 citations in here, and all that's in the very back. So, more research to be done, I suppose. But this citation, interestingly enough, is listed as an interview with one Christopher Key in March of 2017. And after posting that on Twitter, me and some other people tried to find out who a Christopher Key was and what he was doing in March of 2017. That was of relation to Gamergate. And we found nothing. Hmm. So I'm led to believe that that citation is a load of bullshit. Which also begs the question of how many other citations are a load of bullshit?
It's a good question. So, in the Talon Silverbane wants to know, in this book, did they claim the evils done by the USSR and the People's Republic of China were not true communism, or was that secret capitalism?
They were authoritarian states, and in order to be true communist states, the state has to be abolished. So communist state is sort of an oxymoron there. In order for there to be a true socialism, it has to be anarcho-socialism.
So he falls back on the not real socialism argument.
Yeah, he does. But he doesn't call it capitalism at the very least, but he does say the idea of a state allowed it to become authoritarian, and he is very anti-authoritarian.
Or so he says.
True.
And we'll get to why that's ridiculous here in a second. Matchstick 7886 asks, how long till Antifa from other nations get labeled as domestic terrorists, such as UK, Sweden, etc.? I'll take this one. Probably longer, because they probably have people who are sympathetic to them in the governments of those nations, which is sad. Goodness. Here's and we've discussed this before. How on earth do you have a communist state without a large centralized government?
You can't.
It's impossible.
Literally the only way that you could is on a smaller scale in communes. But as we are becoming a globalized society, that is becoming more and more impossible. Else we would essentially have to become smaller, I suppose, city-states. And even then, you know, that would require some form of government. Much less some way to defend yourself from some crazy that decides he's going to conquer everything. But of course, we already deal with that problem with nations, so what's the point?
Well, yeah, it brings up the question, rather, that what do you do when somebody says, screw you?
No.
Then you're going to have a war on your hands.
Yeah. And if you abolish the military and the police and prisons for restorative justice,
nah.
What are you going to do? Slap him on the hand and say, all right, don't do that again.
Well, I imagine it would probably end the way that it always ends. People would end up dead.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I understand it. If you abolish police, abolish prisons, abolish the military, offenders get the bullet.
Yes.
Execution by firing squad. Okay.
It's as Peter Hitchens said more than once. He actually tweeted me about this, which that was an honor. That the road to utopia is always paved in blood, and you never get there.
Of course.
And I apologize to the live chat. I'm going to have to squint to see you because I have a headache, so I took my glasses off for a bit. Let's see.
They want, John Matrix says, so they want big government to abolish government? No. They want to abolish government through a violent revolution.
How blatant is he about that?
It is hinted at, veiled throughout most of it, but then in that one section that I read about class war and destroying or capturing states, he makes it very apparent that is what has to be done. He does describe Antifa violence as, quote, militant self-defense. The idea that it is justified because it is defending either your livelihood or the livelihood of some marginalized group or some, what's the word I'm looking for? Vulnerable group. There we go.
Just to answer a question that was directed towards me, the quote was from Peter Hitchens that he had done in an interview. And then the last part, and you never get there, he actually said to me specifically. So, like I said, that was an honor. I hold Christopher Hitchens in a fairly high regard in regards to his journalistic work. Not his discussion on theology, obviously. But I hold his brother in a much higher regard, both as a journalist and as a theologian as well. So he's a very gracious individual, very blunt, but always on point.
The Randall Graves, he's blunt, but he has a point approach.
Mm-hmm.
Panda Pal says, of course it's justified because minorities can't speak for themselves according to Antifa. Actually, that's interesting, because Bray is, or was, I guess, a part of Occupy Wall Street. He was an organizer.
Why am I not surprised?
Yeah, so he ascribes by the progressive stack, of course. So it is the marginalized or victimized people that should be the leaders of this, should be at the forefront, essentially.
But he's a fucking white male.
Yes, yes he is. And that's all you have to say. Obviously, everything that he says is invalid because he is a white male. I mean, that's how it works. But as far as the militant self-defense thing goes, he more or less argues that there's only one form of socially accepted, or the one form of violence that is socially accepted, and that is self-defense. You know, you don't attack somebody and then say, oh, well, it was justified because they pissed me off. No, you have to say, oh, I was defending myself. I was defending someone else.
It's coming right for us. It's South Park logic.
Exactly, exactly. You know, look out. It's coming right for us. You know, I was standing my ground. It's ridiculous because you could easily use that argument, even though he doesn't explicitly do it in here, but you could easily use that argument to justify violence against police.
Oh, absolutely.
Because he does say that police are basically enforcers of the fascist state or the neo-fascist state. So, because of that, you could easily, hand wave away. What was his name? Micah Xavier Johnson's killing of 5 cops. All right.
How do they plan to fight off tanks and people with guns? Here's one thing that needs saying is that the United States military would never roll a tank on American soil. Ever. They would never. That's one thing that a lot of people don't understand is that tanks, jets, a lot of our offensive gear is not meant to be used on American soil because the collateral damage would be too great. And I think he knows that, because at the end of the day, it would be a ground war. There's too much. Almost every single, or most of the United States is populated by at least somebody, unless we all plan on fighting in the Nevada desert. And I have a feeling that wouldn't work out. But
nah, why not? Conflict in Death Valley.
Oh, the irony. But there is an assumption. I think that I do find hilarious is that Antifa thinks that they could overthrow the country.
Oh yeah, I mean it's tacitly argued that people in the military would come around, or that when you mobilize the general population, you will have the manpower to take over. But
that's two big assumptions right there.
Yeah,
it's one that the military would come around, and two that the general population would come around. The military would never come around.
No. Speaking to
well, here's one question: how many of those generals that we have nowadays were involved in the military during the Cold War? A lot of them. Two, what makes you think that our heavily armed citizenry would follow this sort of thing? If anything, both of them would turn their guns on Antifa. And then it wouldn't be a fight, it would be a squash match.
Simply put, how many of them are conservatives?
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, that's going to be a pretty big shift from right wing to far left.
Yes.
So, That right there. I mean, speaking to some ex-military friends of mine, even they were like, no, this is clearly a situation where you would have to fight these guys if you took any sort of military oath, because they would be considered enemies of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And I would definitely consider that that bit about wanting to capture or destroy states of the world, including the U.S., to be a, you know, manifesto of the, or not manifesto, but a statement of war, maybe? Maybe not war. Maybe war is a little strong to use, but then again, he did say he wants class war, so. That's something that you could use to prove that an individual or group would be considered an enemy combatant.
It's part of the reason why I think that labeling them a terrorist group was such a much wiser, or a very wise move. Some people argued against it. Oddly enough, some conservatives argued against it because they said, oh, this needs to be handled on a state-to-state level. There's a problem. The state stopped doing anything about them in certain places.
It's like when Ben Shapiro came to Berkeley recently.
Yes.
And we did a live stream about it. We were totally expecting shit to go down.
And we ended up talking about everything else because nothing went down.
Yeah, nothing went down. Why? Because there was police presence there. Because they treated Antifa like, I don't know, a terrorist group, maybe? Or at least a tier under that.
Yes.
And nothing happened. A few people were arrested for smacking each other upside the head, and that was it.
Yep. No bike locks. No nothing like that.
No bike locks. No shootings. No trash cans being tipped over and set on fire.
Speaking of which, I don't suppose he mentioned Eric Clanton in his book, did he?
I don't believe so.
That's one thing that's interesting is his arguments. I'm assuming that Clanton probably agrees, in which case I'm wondering in this upcoming court case if he's going to make that same attempt to say that he was preemptively defending himself.
Don't believe so. Let's see. Let me flip back through Battle of Berkeley.
Because and I feel bad for the guy who got hit with the bike lock. I mean, I've been hit upside the head with a lot of things. 2x4s, fists. I had a box full of books land on my head when I was moving once. I've been hit with a lock, too, on accident. Woof. that one does hurt. So
I do not see anything about Eric Clinton.
Okay. I didn't think that there would be. I just figured it would be an interesting shot in the dark. But regardless. Going back to the federal government thing. We also have to keep in mind that supposedly, I don't think it was ever really proven, or at least not to my satisfaction, that but there might be some not evidence at least of sympathies with by any means necessary from the Berkeley mayor. So it's, and by any means necessary is tied to Antifa. So it's a this is part of the reason as to why we do have a federal government. We are at the point of, or at least I believe so, and maybe not everyone agrees with me, but I think that we've definitely come to the point where when you got more than one riot happening in the streets, more than one protest that goes violent, that is the point where the Fed is supposed to step in, because the states are clearly overwhelmed or are unwilling to protect their own citizens.
Absolutely. Donnie C. Star asks, what other conservatives were mentioned besides the obvious Trump, Shapiro, Milo, etc. I don't remember if Ben Shapiro was actually mentioned in here, but of course Steve Bannon was, Ann Coulter was, Lauren Southern was, and there was one more. It wasn't Cernovich. Oh,
Mark Dice, maybe?
Nah, might be, but I don't think so. Oh, shoot. Who was at, oh, Richard Spencer was mentioned, but I don't know if I'd really call him a conservative.
No, he's a national socialist.
Marine Le Pen, of course. Nigel Farage, of course.
Farage? Huh.
Yes, Brexit was covered.
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm. They did actually talk about, if you remember this, a redneck revolt.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yep, they got a little section. That was funny.
Yes, I remember us reporting on that.
Yeah, because they likened them to a leftist gun club, such as the Maoist Red Guards in Austin, Texas. And the one with the best name, I believe, the LGBTQ Trigger Warning Gun Club in Rochester, New York.
I think of groups that are most likely to commit suicide, that's probably going to be number one.
Probably so, but you have to admit, that name is actually hilarious.
Yes it is.
Alright, let's see if they have any more. Was PewDiePie mentioned? No, PewDiePie did not get a mention in this. I believe this was before PewDiePie jumped all in this.
Benjamin Blokel asks if it would have been James Alsop.
That... Actually, I think so. Because that sounds a bit more familiar. I think so, actually. I'm gonna say yes. But yeah, no, this book, this came out in August, so that was before, or maybe during the time that PewDiePie was getting lynched.
Well, it's after the first one. Because this usually the end one was lynching, but number two.
Yeah, well, that was the big one, though.
Lynching two, lynching Boogaloo.
was Hat mentioned? Was I mentioned? No.
No. We're small fries.
I was not mentioned.
Panda Palace asks, did he ever acknowledge the incongruities of having most of their membership consist of upper middle class bourgeoisie retarded fuckwit hormonally challenged male adolescents? That's a mouthful.
No.
What about Sargon? Is a question that
Sargon
Aaron
was not in there.
Sounds like he was kind of avoiding the internet sphere in a lot of ways.
In some ways, yes, though, had this book come out later on, probably after, say, like VidCon, or, yeah, I guess it did come out after VidCon.
Mm.
I guess if it was still being written at the time of VidCon, because I presume it was sent to the printers around that time, then it very likely would have included something about the rise of the right-wing fascist YouTubers like Sargon and etc. And I'm quite certain that if it were going to be released, say, next year, it would have a bit in there about comics and probably diversity in comics, too.
Mm.
But no, me and Micah were not mentioned.
No.
No. Nobody in Gamergate really was mentioned except for Milo. So no, if you're looking for a book that name drops this, keep on yeah, looking.
Definitely not this one.
Was Vox Dei mentioned? I don't remember. I don't think so. I don't believe he was. Because the whole rabid puppies thing wasn't talked about.
Hmm.
Or sad puppies or whatever it was. Mm. Puppies. No, there was the little talk about culture wars in general, outside of just the general right versus left as we know it culture war, not so much like in media. Is Mark Bray an intellectual or professor? I believe he's a PhD candidate at Drexel?
I want to say it's Drexel, yeah.
No. Dartmouth.
Dartmouth, that's it. Drexel's the other guy.
Yeah, he's a lecturer at Dartmouth also. I'll just read this. Mark Bray is a historian of human rights, terrorism, and political radicalism in modern Europe and was one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street. He is the author of Translating Anarchy, The Anarchism of Occupy Wall Street, and co-editor of Anarchist Education and the Modern School at Francisco Ferrer Reader, publishing in spring 2008. His work has appeared in Foreign Policy, Critical Quarterly, Roar Magazine, and numerous edited volumes. He is currently a lecturer at Dartmouth College.
Yes. Drexel is George Ciceriello, the one who has made a bunch of... He's basically a Venezuela apologist.
And, was he the giraffe?
No, he's not the giraffe. That's a different one. Ciceriello is the Goonie Beard Man one. Looks kind of like if Ben Kuchera still had
hair. Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah, he appeared on Tucker Carlson and got ate up.
Was Jordan B. Peterson in the book? I don't believe so. I don't remember seeing Jordan Peterson's name.
I wouldn't think that he would be. It seems like also a lot of what is being mentioned is governmental elements as opposed to anything entertainment or socially.
And no, this is not the UK version of Dartmouth, whatever.
Yeah.
This is the American version, where we pronounce every bit of it. All right, where else are we going? What are the other questions we got?
And I think we've gone over everybody who might be in the book, guys. So... Does the podcast still... if there are any questions in regards to Antifa on the Twitter hashtag, we will definitely be answering them today. Let me pull that up real quick.
Yeah, we're doing just an Antifa episode today. So if you ask stuff that's not about that, we'll get to it on another occasion.
Panda Palace makes a very good point in the chat here. It says, I love that it's always professors peddling this horse shit, not realizing they will eat the bullet first. Well, yeah, it seems that a lot of them didn't learn from Pol Pot.
Hmm. Well, it's funny because a lot of those professors also, at least the older ones, the ones that already have tenure, were a part of groups like Students for a Democratic Society way back when.
Mm-hmm.
And those were, I would argue, Antifa light groups. They just weren't militant about it, unless you consider, you know, whether underground, but... Anyway, yeah, so that's really where they're getting it from. It's the same politics, just they might not publicly, at least, agree with the tactics. Though, again, if we take the logic to its conclusion, if you want a communist state, you have to fight for it physically.
Sadly, it was around this time that we actually had a power outage in my recording studio at home, so we weren't able to finish the questions that we really wanted to finish. Luckily for you guys, on the YouTube channel, there is an exclusive video in regards to that, where Hatman and I did a much more casual stream, talking with the fan base, and answering some more questions about the Anti-Fascist Handbook, and a few other things. So, youtube.com/user/cynicscorner is where you're going to want to go for that. We do appreciate everyone who came out, and for everyone who is subscribing to the podcast on iTunes, and tune in next week for more politics and entertainment goodness. In the meantime, my name is Micah Curtis. We will see you next week. Deus vult.